Communications disruption can mean only one thing: invasion.
You must contact me.
Negotiation? We've lost all communication.
Hello, howdy, aloha, and welcome to CO Bibbles Babble Bubble, your one-stop droid pit stop, probably two stops too many, for all things prequels appreciation. We are in the second episode of an ongoing series of the magical, wonderful world of Disney during the prequels eras 1999 through 2005. So last week, I was joined by Kay Harmonizer to talk about the animated Disney films, such as why Monsters, Inc. really taught the whole generation of children to hate capitalism, and how there's a lot of stuff that wouldn't fly, even though it was just 20 years ago. But on this this week, this special episode, I'm joined by Claire Stribbs of the Imperial Senate podcast. It's great to finally have you on the show.
I'm so excited. This has been a long time coming. We finally made it.
Yes, we finally got things to work. And for a very great conversation topic, too. So we're sticking with the Disney theme. But we're going to look at sort of an overlooked window of Disney content. What also happens to be the strongest numbers of Disney content. And that is the famous Disney Channel original movies. So just to put things in perspective here. So between 1999 and 2005, we had 3 Star Wars films come out. In that same length of time, we had 36 Disney Channel original movies. So that means that for every single Star Wars that came out, there was not 1, not 2, not 3, not 4, not 5, not 6, not 7, not 8, not 9, not 10, not 11, but 12 Disney Channel original movies to accompany with it, all which have been taken out of the vault, the Disney vault, and put onto Disney Plus so we can revisit these wonderful little forays into our childhood here and realize, you know, was it okay to have a crush on so-and-so back then, or were standards improved?
For some of these people, so real.
You know, for some of these people, my standards are still the same because they, you know, they grew up attractive too. And anyhow, also, we can just hope when we're talking about some of them, they're over 18 at the time they filmed the movie, so it's not weird. Some of them may still be under. I don't know. We're not gonna touch about that. Any fondness is talking, assuming I was a child, preteen.
We're taking a walk down memory lane, you know?
A walk down memory lane. So to get started, what we're going to do is we're going to try to go chronologically through, not all of them, because there's quite a few, but just kind of our favorites for each year and just what the movie means to us. If we can tie it back to Star Wars somehow, that's great, but not mandatory, but it can be done. And yeah, so this is really... kind of just a free flow conversation. So let's get started. 1999, first movie of the year, January 23rd. Kind of the thing that kickstarted a whole love of space and science fiction for a whole generation. You know, I really think The Phantom Menace would not have done as well in theaters had there not been a group of people who had seen Xenon, Girl of the 21st Century.
Zoom, zoom, zoom. Make my heart go boom, boom. So many supernova girls were in the audience at Phantom Menace. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so much. What was his name again? It was, Protozoa. Thank you, Protozoa, for gifting us and the Microbes. I think that was the name of the band. As a total dork who loves bad puns, that's just everything I've ever wanted. But I totally, you know, like just thinking about all of the science fiction films, there were a couple of them that came out in 99. And honestly, I would say that probably the marketing for Star Wars coming back, inspiring these kids, knowing that there was going to be new space fantasy movies. You know what? I think Disney's not a dumb company. They pay attention to what's going on. And then that's why they blessed us with Xenon. Sweet, sweet Xenon.
It's why they also gave us the film Can of Worms, because they knew that The Phantom Menace was going to open up a whole can of worms. In the trolley group of the fandom, and so Disney's just that predictive of it everything. I actually never saw the movie Can of Worms. I didn't even know there was a movie called Can of Worms. I happened to be cheating and have the list right in front of me. Clearly, you know, not a favorite staple.
Not mine either. I've seen it Do I remember much about it? No. And when I was looking at this list of movies, I'm like, is this going to be one that I revisit? No, no. but that's okay. I'm sorry if Can of Worms is your favorite DCOM original or whatever. But yeah, got a hard pass on that. Plus, 1999 is such a good year. That's not the one. That's not the highlight of 99. There's so many competing for that title.
Yeah, it snuck in there. Though it is neat. They did get Malcolm McDowell of Clockwork Orange to lend his voice in the film to play Barnabas, who I think is one of the worms. No, it's an alien dog. Oh, who is like a worm dog thing. So they got Malcolm McDowell. So I think we're overlooking a great bit of acting expertise.
The here. Words alien worm dog thing just totally took me back, and I'm having like flashbacks of watching this movie as a child now. Oh my god, alien worm dog thing. Makes sense.
So maybe the film is more memorable than we're giving credit to. But like you said, 1999, that is a strong year. So in addition to Xenon, what I consider kind of the holy trinity of 1999 is rounded out by Xenon, Johnny Tsunami, in the 13th yes. year. Smart House is sitting on the outskirts there.
Ooh.
It's very predictive, but I really think that Johnny Tsunami in the 13th year gave us two really great protagonists.
Oh, that okay, so Johnny Tsunami was one that I watched literally yesterday because I'm like, how have I not seen this movie in like 15 years? That movie holds up. It's so good. And also, it brought us the slang term totally nectar, which I think I need to like weave back into the fabric of my vocabulary, because there's a lot of things that are not so totally nectar right now going on in the world. But Johnny Tsunami is not one of those things.
What I like about Johnny Tsunami is I think it introduces, I mean, I there weren't that many films in 1997 and 98 when the Disney Channel original movie branding started. And then before that, they had this other thing called Disney Channel Premiere Films, but of the DCOMs, as the DCOMs, because we're going to use abbreviations here because it's a mouthful. Johnny Tsunami was the first to come up with a format that you see all the time in Disney Channel original movies. Like, hey, look at me. I'm a superstar or really good at X. Normally it's some sport. But then due to circumstances, I have to see if I'm good at this completely opposite, different thing. You know, Johnny Tsunami, he boarded so that eventually Troy Bolton could fly. You know, it's they're all tied together. It's just very intricate. You know, anytime it's a male protagonist, like 9 times out of 10, it's because like, oh, I'm really good at this particular sport. There's no way I can also do this. And lo and behold, if you're athletic at one thing, you can be good at another.
Sometimes, you know, it translates.
Yeah, they didn't take as large of a leap as like from basketball to singing that we see in High School Musical, because like snowboarding, surfboarding, they're still you know, it's board sports through and through. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but they're beginning to sow the seeds of a generation believing that being a multi-sport, multifaceted, super talented person, you know, anything's possible. This is what's inspiring millennials. It's like, oh, I don't want to be a career person. I want to, you know, be someone who follows my vocation and can move around, and I don't want to be at one company. I'll be like Johnny Tsunami. Maybe I'll be working corporate life for 5 years and then go work at a nonprofit for 5 years and be just as successful and jump around. And maybe I'll go to law school later, because, you know, the world is your oyster. You can, your Hawaiian oyster that's in Vermont or
your
Maine.
Your Hawaiian oyster.
What is it, Vermont or Maine or New Hampshire? I don't know where. I did not rewatch that one.
You know what? I don't remember exactly what state it was. I just remember the iconic exchange where Johnny finds out that he's moving to the mainland. And he's like, we're moving out east. He's like, oh, shoot. I don't know the geography of Hawaii. I don't remember. He's like, oh, we're going to Kauai. I'm sorry if you're from Hawaii and that's not on the east. And he's like, no, I mean like the east coast of the mainland. You're like, oh, no. Poor yeah, Johnny.
There's some great reveals in the whole Johnny Tsunami cinematic universe. I forget if, I think we just miss, yeah, his sequel.
Back on
Johnny,
board,
yeah, Johnny
baby.
Kapahala, Back on Board. That's 2007, but I think a certain point needs to be drawn to it in terms of just what a complete, like how completely oblivious old Johnny is. You know, when he goes to visit his grandpa and he's like, oh, I can't wait to meet my uncle. Yeah. And you know, meet my new step uncle, and it turns out to be like a 12-year-old Jake Austin. Like, what? Oh my God!
Oh, Jake Austin, sweet pup. It's so funny though. Like, I gotta give like a shout out to Johnny Tsunami in general, and because, you know, a lot of times there's not a huge amount of diversity in the Disney Channel content. There's like a token character. That sounds terrible to say, but oftentimes that was the case. Johnny Tsunami has a white mom. He has a Hawaiian dad and grandfather. He's got like that movie is so full of like diverse situations. You've got like and plus you've got like why am I blanking here? And strange family structures, having an uncle that's younger than you. Like that movie is actually pretty rad. And both of those movies are just super rad, and it's really cool to see. It's just really cool to see that in 1999, sometimes they got a few things right, mm-hmm. and celebrating all cultures and family structures. Shout out to Johnny.
Shout out to Johnny. Yeah, who I think we need to find the director on that one because he really deserves whoever wrote the script there. That is a Steve Boyum film.
Steve who?
Steve. Oh, no, Bo Yum or Boy Um.
It's Boy B-O. Yum. Mm.
Maybe he shouldn't make that film. Oh, Boy Yum. Johnny Tsunami. Mm. Oh, he was a stunt performer first. That's funny. He was a stunt performer in Lethal Weapon 2, the Patriot Games, True Lies, Ooh. The Blues Brothers, and Apocalypse Now. And then he went into directing.
Okay, mad respect to Boy Yum.
Boy Yum. Mm.
Boy Yum. Your track record, it holds up, bro. That is totally Nectar.
It's holding up indeed.
Also, as a kid.
Totally Nectar.
But also, like, as a kid who skis, I was always so mad at the skiers in Johnny Tsunami, but I was infinitely jealous of, like, the group of friends that had matching jackets, matching yellow ski jackets, and, like, black and white patterned hats. I was like, they look so freaking cool. I'll never be that cool.
No, I feel like just in any sort of like ski snowboarding movie, like the cool kids in those movies are always like impossibly cool.
Oh yeah. Trust fund babies.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh yeah, you know, I have my house in Aspen. I just come to the local place and we're gonna shut down the cool hangout spot for the kids to.
We gotta divide the mountain. We can't be seen with snowboarders.
Divide the mountain. Oh, that's so great. Good.
Oh,
it's snow.
Like,
oh gosh, but
that's one thing as well that I think is a lovely trend in the Disney Channel movies is like a lot of the major drama is the stupidest shit I've ever heard of in my life. It's like. So in what universe would somebody wanting to make money owning this ski snowboarding mountain, why would you want to alienate a whole bunch of people? Also, every parent struggle, like every bad parent-kid interaction is like, no parent would ever say or do this. Like,
oh, in any of these movies, yeah.
So good. But it makes for excellent drama.
It does, no. And, like, when you're watching it as a kid, you're like, yeah, man.
Parents Mom and Dad don't understand.
It can be really tough sometimes, and I feel like this movie speaks to me because, you know, my mom wants me to do the dishes more, and I just want to be like Johnny Tsunami, man.
It's like, I don't want to, like, why doesn't my mom and dad want me to go snowboard? They just want me to study. That's not me. That's not me, bro. Yeah.
Man, so classic film. We could spend a whole multiple hours on Johnny there, but we still have about 30 more films left to go, at least where we are in the chronological. We haven't even really talked about the 13th year, other than the fact that it's just a comical premise, as is most of these things, that the boy finds out he's a mermaid. And that's why he's really good on the swimming team.
The 13th year walked so that the luck of the Irish could run. Honestly.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It was that. Dipping the toes into the mythical creature waters. And I like the guy who plays the tuba or the sousaphone or whatever, who, like, shows up at swim meets, and then he falls in the pool really early on in that movie. Like, oh, yeah, Who swim team? You know, your swim team's got the school band showing up.
Like, maybe if the school band, well, first of all, we didn't have a swim team because I'm in, you know, I live in an area without a whole lot of pools. Definitely not school pools. But I wish the band, marching band, would show up at the swim meets. Then maybe I would have gotten into swimming.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that'd be great. I mean, it'd be funny, though, because if you were swimming, like, I know from, like, a football player's perspective, one thing they love is getting to hear the band play a hype-up song through the entirety and, like, yeah, I'm feeling it. But, you know, if you're swimming, you're only getting, like, every third note. So yeah. It'd be, like, this really spooky, fractured version. The, barn, ooh, fight, you know, something like that.
I love also the idea of, like, the underwater garbled sound of tuba music. I just think that would be a lovely sensory experience.
Yeah, put the band in the pool. You have to swim around them. Like, the trombones are the real trap because you have to time your strokes accordingly or else they're going to cut you off when they, what is that, slide the bar? I don't know the correct terminology for a trombone.
Fake fan.
Yeah, no, I like this. Underwater band, unique sound. Because that way, yeah, because when you're swimming, you spend more time underwater than above surface. You know, the swimmers will get to hear more of the sound. That's who it's for. You
know? Exactly.
Absolutely. Might as well throw underwater dance teams and cheerleaders in there, too. Put the fans in the water. That's what we really want to see.
You put cheerleaders in synchronized swimming routines.
Yeah. I like it. You just keep the middle two lanes empty, and that's where the cheerleaders go. Also, here's an idea, thinking it on the spot. How come people don't hold swim meets at, like, venues similar to, like, a polar bear tank? You know, at a zoo? You know, like, you can see the polar bear swimming and, like, be kind of underneath it or see it when it's on land. That would be awesome for swim meets. You could be, like, standing underneath the swimmers. Or, like, in a tunnel, like those walk-through aquariums, you know, where you got water on all sides. Like, that'd be so neat. That would totally redefine, like, people being... I mean, Michael Phelps is gone, so why should we watch swimming? You know, you need to have a hook. And clearly, none of these swimmers are, you know, are former mermaids because they're all over 13. So we know that all the pros out there, you know, missed that opportunity.
Definitely missed that opportunity. And also, that is kind of xenophobic towards mermaid culture. I'm just saying, why are we excluding some of the finest swimmers from our swim meets? Step your shit up, Olympics.
Tisk, tisk, tisk. I mean, you know, that you think they could win. We got some fast dudes. I mean, I saw Michael Phelps race against a shark on Animal Planet.
Oh, that's so right. I forgot about that.
Which I can't tell you how disappointing it was that it wasn't actually him racing against a shark in the same water.
I want my money back, Animal Planet.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping for. But no, they're like, let's measure how fast he can speed. And then let's computer simulate a shark going against him. Nah, boo. Put him in a water with a great white.
Give the people what they want.
Cover him up in, like, cocktail sauce and be like, okay, Michael, go.
Cover him up in cocktail sauce.
Leaving a tomato saucy trail behind his wake.
Oh, my goodness.
Swimming, man. Good stuff. No, I was not a swimmer. I can swim. That's not to say I'm not a... casual. I swim for socially, I guess you could say. You know, like drinking socially. I'm not a swimaholic, but if given the opportunity, you know, who am I to say no to slip on the trunks and test my 13th year skill?
Test your 13th year. I think we're past our prime on that front there.
Yeah, right? missed opportunity. You know, maybe I wonder if you're born on a leap day, right? Do you have to wait till you turn, I guess, what is it, 13 times 4? When you're 52, is that your, do you become a mermaid then? Because that's technically your 13th year of your birthday?
Like, that is a very good question.
Yeah, there's a bunch of 52-year-olds who could have just turned mermaids in February, since this was a leap year. You know, we can imagine, we can hope, we can pray.
We really can. That's all we've got.
They probably get ostracized by the rest of mermaid society. It's like, oh man, we've been doing our mermaid thing for like 49 years, and you're just catching up. 39 years, man.
What a loser.
Loser. Duh.
That's got to be the sequel to 13th year. That's how we get back on board with the mermaids. I think that would... I'd love to know.
52nd year.
52nd year.
It's the swim coach's turn. Or the kid who played the tuba. He's all grown up.
Oh,
poor guy.
Poor buddy.
Oh, man. Yeah, but yeah, 1999. Then there's a Smart House, which, like I said, I think it's on the outside looking in, but I think this movie has definitely gotten more of a cult following recently because it's getting pretty predictive of technology.
Yeah, they, you know what? That's kind of groundbreaking. You know, before there was Alexa, there was the Smart House.
There was the Smart House, yeah. I mean, who would have thought that when this movie came out that, you know, we would have thought the 13th year was more realistic than the Smart House. And, you know, we got flipped on our heads there. So that, you know, clearly Smart House won the realism battle against the boy turning into a mermaid, but...
And don't forget the that Smart House is a cautionary tale, so maybe unplug your Alexa every now and then, ladies and gents.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Well, I don't have any more on the 99 movies, but I'd hate to pass over if you're just dying to talk about Horse Sense or Genius.
Believe it or not, those are ones that I did skip over as well. I'm sorry to all of you Horse Sense stans out there, but yeah.
Horse Sense stans. Man,
all
you know,
secret horse girls out there.
We're going to get just absolutely just blocked on Twitter and social media. Like, oh my God, you guys hate Horse Sense. You're horrible. That's writing. It's based on Jane Austen. Maybe. I have no idea.
I have no idea either. I don't remember anything about that movie.
Oh, this is a boy film. They got boys in this one.
Ooh.
Good for them. Most horse films are, you know, it's about a girl who's like, oh, I got in a horrible accident. I can never ride horses again. But wait, this horse is magical somehow, so I can ride. We're going to win the big race. Like, that's like the whole format for most horse movies. Unless it's like... depressing horse movie where, like, the horse gets sent to a glue factory. But then rescued at the end by, like, a kind-hearted older man who wants to get it for his daughter. But I'm glad we're saying that boys can like horses, too.
That's right. Y'all are sexist.
The main character, Michael Woods, a lazy, preppy 20-year-old living off his parents' wealth in L.A., kind of looks a little bit like Chris Pine in his profile. Here
oh, my God.
He's got a cell phone that has one of those, like, you know, you could pull the antennas out for better reception.
Oh my God, we are blessed.
Yeah, so whoever this non-Chris Pines is, Joseph Lawrence. Oh, he was in there with his brother. Unless there's another, are they related? Andrew Lawrence. Oh yes, that actually was his brother. So, you know, two brothers were in that movie.
Wow.
And his brother, holy cow, his brother's the voice of TJ from Recess. We're just getting lost.
Wait, really?
Dead serious. Man, that is so funny. He's
crap,
a voice actor.
I think I have to watch Horse Sense.
You know what? That's the problem with this whole exercise. The moment you feel like, ah, this is a stupid movie, I'm not going to watch it, then, like, you realize it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and you're, like, two bottles of wine in and crying to the closing scenes of Horse Sense.
Absolutely.
That horse taught that boy such a lesson.
Oh, God.
Anyhow, so year 2000. So we both admitted this before starting the call that 2000 is definitely the weakest year of the prequels era. But I have to give, it also happened to have the most movies, but I want to give a little round of applause because the movie, The Color of Friendship, was a rather bold thing for Disney to do back then. Do you remember, like, did you watch this one?
I did watch The Color of Friendship. That movie is actually pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's quality film. I'm surprised that, like, I mean, the first time I saw it, I didn't know it was a Disney Channel original movie. I just thought it was like a full-fledged Disney movie they were showing on the Disney Channel at the time. Because it's got, you know, really deep messaging. It took place, or the film came out 6 years after the end of apartheid. So that's still very raw and fresh in the world. But to make this movie that looks into, you know, apartheid South Africa and racial relations and making it take place in the 70s, I think was a very bold move.
It really was. And it's kind of like round of applause to Disney on this one, because they do it in a way that's not that's obviously family friendly as much as you can be when you're talking about apartheid. But it's a really great way to educate kids about racism and some, you know, that people aren't so different after all. And, you know, we just need to take time to understand and not jump to conclusions about who you think people are. And it's pretty, that movie's actually pretty cool. The rest of 2000 is kind of rough, but that movie's pretty cool.
No, that is definitely the diamond in the rough for sure. I mean, it introduces, I mean, without explicitly saying it, kind of the idea that race is, you know, a social construct, the concept of it. Nationality is a social construct. You know, this whole idea of expecting, oh, what is someone from Africa like? What is someone from the United States like in the eyes of both of the girls? And, yeah, it's a good movie. Like, I honestly think it's probably, out of all the movies in this list, top five in terms of, like, quality.
Absolutely.
And it's charming, too. But yeah, the rest of 2000's pretty weak. You got some great names, some good titles in there. Mom's Got a Date with a Vampire. I think, you know, that's pretty solid. Phantom of the Megaplex, that probably Phantom introduced a whole introduction to the, you know, the grander Phantom cinematic universe.
Quince, perfect birth control for any children who, you know, want to make some frisky moves. Mom and Dad have Quince. Yep. Nobody wants that.
Alley Cat Strike. This is another movie that kind of fits the format that we were talking about earlier, introduced in Johnny Tsunami, where a basketball team ties in the state championship. In the tiebreakers, the two schools have to bowl against one another.
Which, as an idea, as a concept, is just the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, but I'm here for it. You know what? It's a Disney Channel. They sometimes are a little fuzzy with their logic, but I'm good with it.
It's just really, it's clever. I mean, whoever came up with that must have one hell of imagination. Like, you know, I'm putting them on like C.S. Lewis and like Tolkien level imagination here. We're talking about to be like, how are we going to determine who wins the state basketball championship? Let's see. Basketball. That begins with a B. Baseball. No, that's too hard. We can't teach the kids how to play baseball that quickly. Badminton. No, we don't have the nets. Bowling. Yes, bowling. There we go. Bowling is going to determine the winner. Now, question, are we going to bowl with basketballs, or are we going to play basketball with bowling balls? Oh, man. No, it's a good concept. I'll give it that. And, Miracle in Lane 2, Steph's Sister from Planet Weird. I mean, that sounds like one of those books you pick up, like, next to the Goosebump novels or something.
It really, like, okay, so I don't know if you remember anything about Steph's Sister from Planet Weird. This is not one that I rewatched. But is one of the sisters, is she related to Macaulay Culkin in any way? Because they look identical. Identical. Wow. Good thing I could talk. It's not like I podcast or anything.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think he has any sisters because he has his two brothers. Rory and Kieran are the two other Culkins out there. But it could be a cousin.
She looks just so much like him. So go, for all of you who don't remember that movie, go Google it. The One in the Pink. I just.
The One in the Pink. You don't know their names.
I don't. It's been so long since I've seen that movie. Oh, God. Good times, though.
Good stuff. So now we jump to 2001, where, you know, Disney Channel offers us the first sequel of any Disney Channel original movie. When we have, you know, almost to the day, a 2-year anniversary of Xenon. We get Xenon the Zequel, spelled with a Z.
Yes! The Xenon Cinematic Universe is probably my favorite of all of the Disney Cinematic Universes.
They really need bring it back. Can you imagine if they brought up back a Xenon film or miniseries and put it on Disney Plus? Just how bananas,
oh my God,
everyone would be.
That would be amazing. Also, this is the one, I can't remember. Margaret? Oh, what was the name of the friend?
There's Margie or Margie.
Yeah, Raven was the original one, and then they recast her for the second, and then they brought her back for the third?
Yeah, I don't know if she was... I guess she may have just been filming her... I don't remember when That's So Raven was airing.
Oh,
this was in the middle of that, and then... Because she has... Like, Cheetah Girls is happening... Well, I guess that's a little bit later. Cheetah Girls is until 2003. But yeah, that the casting change was very, very odd there. They should have gone the Princess Diaries route and just, you know, cut the best friend and add a new one. Which happened in Princess Diaries 2, happened to also be Raven. So, you know, there we go. It all circles around her. That's a time that
Damn you, Raven.
Raven Simone's been involved in a good soft recast versus a hard recast that we see in the Xenon cinematic universe. After Xenon, I mean, these three movies, back to back to back, January, February, March 2001, we were blessed, because after Xenon comes Motocross.
Ugh, that movie's so rad.
That movie is action-packed. And, you know, it's a adaptation of Twelfth Night, so I think that helped introduce some people to Shakespeare a little bit there.
Absolutely. This is probably one of my favorite Disney Channel original movies. I loved Motocross. It was so good. Also, like, every single person in this film had that classic early 2000s blonde spiky hair.
Oh, God bless. Yeah.
That was always perfect when you took your helmet off, including our heroine, our main character, when she cuts her hair to look like her brother to take his spot in the race. I'm like, oh, my God, even you have hot boy hair. I can't.
I'll tell you what, it's something else. It really opened, really bent the boundaries of, you know, sort of teenage gender roles there and who could achieve what, who should look which way. It's really a well done motion picture right there. And, you know, it really, it got lower Nielsen ratings than it should have. Clearly, it developed a far greater following later in life, but more people should have been watched it.
Like, as a girl watching that movie as a little, what was it, 2000?
2001.
2001. As a little six-year-old watching that movie and seeing this girl being told, you can't race in the thing, the boys are going to eat you alive, you know, this is for dudes. And dad, like, wanting to protect you, like, that's my little girl, she can't go out and do this dangerous thing, but then why can your son do that? It was pretty cool. I liked that movie a lot. It really did, it did show some of the differences in view when it came to gender, especially in the early 2000s. Girls can't be motocross stars. Girl can't be faster than me on a bike.
But they can.
Psych, bitch.
And be great at it, too.
Exactly. Man. And look just as hot with your haircut.
Exactly. I mean, that's the show. Play around with hairstyles, you know, especially as we're in this age and everyone needs a haircut so desperately. You know, just play around at home and anything can happen.
Exactly. Get your hair, get your scissors out, people.
Snip, snip. Don't forget the dye. Get the little blonde spikes going.
The frosted tips.
Yeah, frosted tips. Less than a month after Motocross blessed the small screen, we get the luck of the Irish, which we hinted at earlier here in the show, but that's a movie right there. I tell you what, there are some things going on.
They acted the shit out of that movie, and I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing. As someone, I mean, I'm 1/6 Irish, so I feel like I can speak on this. Not really, but. Rewatching that movie before this podcast, I'm like, I am offended for the entire actual country of Ireland watching this.
Like they're embarrassed to admit they're Irish. It's like, where are you from? Like, just, we're from Cincinnati, we swear. And like, I'm so sorry, son, we're actually Irish. I lied to you. Please forgive me. Like, what?
Not only are they Irish, they are literal leprechauns.
Literal, and they need the little gold coin.
Yes.
Also, this is yet another movie where I think they're figuring out that basketball is the best sport to focus this stuff around. Because the little Irish guy, little main character, Kyle Johnson, played by the ever-talented Ryan Merriman, you know. Ugh,
my whole heart in my tweenage years was for that man.
Well, because he was in Smart House, mm-hmm. and, you know, luck of the Irish. And was he in Smallville? Or am I just confusing him with someone else there?
I don't remember. I didn't watch all of Smallville, though, so I'm not the right person to ask. Mm-hmm.
Who knows? And I think he's on Pretty Little Liars. He went on to that.
I believe he did, yeah.
Old Ryan Merriman from Choctaw, Oklahoma, because I clearly had that memorized and did not just look at the page for a moment there real quick. No, but yeah, this whole, like, basketball player. So the first time we see the basketball player was back in Alley Cat Strike with the basketball player turned bowling star. Now we have basketball player turned leprechaun. So it's a merger, you know? The Luck of the Irish is 13th year meets Alley Cat's Strike. So
yes,
you know, we're getting there, all clumping together. As for the rest of 2001, after that, I think none of these jump off the page for me, except we do get the second Disney Channel original movie sequel with Halloween Town 2.
Oh, Calabar's freaking revenge, man.
I'm a big fan of the Halloween Town cinematic universe. I think the grandmother, Debbie Reynolds, does just a fantastic job.
She's perfect. Like in every single way, but especially in Halloween Town. I wanted her to be my weird witchy grandma.
Oh, it really was, you know. She is the family member we all wish we had. We all love our grandmothers, of course, and all the maternal persons in our life. This is not meant to replace anybody. But
Definitely not.
To supplement, you know. Let's get old Nana Debbie.
Nana Debbie.
I don't know what her character's name was, but we'll stick with the actors there. And then 'Twas the Night rounds out that year there. Never saw it. I never really watched most of the Christmas Disney Channel original movies.
I didn't either. I totally vibed on the Halloween ones. Like, that's my jam. Like, well, first of all, when you have Halloween Town in your cart, just in general, Halloween is winning. But, like, you know, there were some other pretty good ones in there. Disney Channel was spooky, even when it was really weird. Like, you know, Halloween was the best holiday anyway, though, so it's fine.
Well, I think what was going on is that there were plenty and continue to be plenty of movies that hit the theaters targeted to children that touch upon Christmas. You know, this time all going on. I mean, I don't know the dates off the top of my head, but the Santa Claus movies, Christmas with the Cranks, Polar Express, so on and so forth. But there weren't really kids' Halloween movies. You know, Halloween, like a horror movie would come out or a scary movie, you know, but that's not something that you can go and watch when you're 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and so on. So it's nice that Disney Channel was filling that niche that lets give Halloween associated movies because you can't find them anywhere else right now.
I mean, Disney did an excellent job with that.
They did a wonderful job. And like those movies still absolutely hold their own in their weight. Like I think they're spot on. I mean, you look at some of like the CGI in these movies, like the Halloween Town stuff or Twitches, or even the movies where you feel like this doesn't need CGI, but they put it in there anyhow. And it's pretty bad. You know, they weren't doing it in the, you know, this wasn't any ILM stuff going on there, but.
But are we still blessed that it exists? Yes.
We are still blessed.
Yes, we are.
It exists. So after the kind of the jam-packed years of 2000 and 2001 with a lot of movies, Disney starts to kind of pull back a bit and not roll out as many. They, in 2002, they only give us 8. I know that sounds, or maybe it's just 7. Just 7. That sounds big, but, you know, for Disney Channel, that's on the lower end. And I think the one that really sits out here, though I could see an argument for Get a Clue being the best Disney Channel movie of 2002, I gotta go with Cadet Kelly.
Oh, so good. Cadet Kelly, like, you've got Hilary Duff, you've got, why am I blanking on her name, sister from Even Stevens?
Christy Carlson Romano.
Yes! Like, that movie is also just badass girl power, the movie. You can be pretty and pink, and you can be, you know, killing it on the drill team. Excellent casting. Mm-hmm. Just a fun movie all around.
For sure. It's a home run. Get a Clue, though, I like a lot as well. I think that's kind of a fun little mystery film. It was kind of a coup, in my opinion, for Disney Channel to get Lindsay Lohan for this, you know?
Yes.
Because she was definitely, you know, big screen gal at this time. I don't know where or when Herbie Fully Loaded falls, but we would have already had Parent Trap by this point. And so this is definitely young Lindsay at her finest. So to get her in, like, on a TV, a made-for-TV movie, that just shows the strength and flex of the Disney Channel.
Absolutely.
Long may it rain.
You know, the thing about Get a Clue, it had an excellent theme song. It had a lot of twists and turns. The casting was fabulous. And you had, like, staple of Disney Channel television show and original movies, Miss Brenda Song. Just absolutely killing it. You had the dreamy guy. And you had, you know, it was just a great movie full of twists and turns. And that theme song, I'll probably hear it in my nightmares until the end of time. That movie's really fun, though. And it holds up, I will say. It does hold up for me.
It does. It's funny looking at some of the other films to come out that year. There are some that I could tell you nothing about. A Ray of Endless Light, I have no idea. That movie, that sounds like a Korean horror film.
It really does!
What is this thing about?
I don't remember that one. That's one I probably missed.
Well, because you could tell... I think there weren't many Disney Channel original movies that I saw when they had premiered, you know?
Yes.
Because they were just in the staple that Disney Channel would just roll out randomly. I don't know what was the magical decision-making behind, like, let's show, you know, Cadet Kelly on March 15th, 2004. You know, like, it's for just picking a random date, you know, so... I feel like they certainly phased some of these out of the regular rotation. It wasn't syndicated viewings. And A Ring of Endless Light and The Scream Team, I feel like, did not make the cut.
I will say, knowing how objectively not good that movie is, I have always loved The Scream Team. And I watched some of it, and it does not hold up. That's the one with the... He finds out that their house is a halfway house for spirits, and so it's a weird hodgepodge of ghosts from all different times. And
oh,
I remember watching
I remember that. Okay.
Yeah, and it was objectively not good, and it does not hold up. But that was one of those Halloween movies that when it came on Disney Channel around October, I'd always be like, "Yeah, Scream Team, let's do it." Objectively, does not hold up, but I'll always have a soft spot in my heart for that weird little film.
That weird weird little film indeed. So 2003 has, I would say, one of my favorite Disney Channel original movies, and that's Eddie's Million Dollar Cook-Off.
Yes,
that movie just is truly fantastic. And it's funny how there's certain scenes from any sort of film or television show from a person's childhood or a book that really sticks with you for a long time, or a plot point. And for me, it's Eddie's inability to crack an egg. Because I really sympathize with that. And, like, every time I, like, have a good, like, cracked egg, like, no piece, I mean, it's, like, almost perfectly in half and falls in, I'm like, oh my gosh, I just made Eddie proud. Because this is what he looks like. I still do this every single time I pull out the egg. I think about that movie.
And which is funny, because if you think about being in a million-dollar cook-off and that's your biggest weakness, you're probably going to be okay.
Yeah, like, oh, man, he can't crack eggs right. Like, they're not judging. Cook-offs have never judged you on your technique of making the food. It's how it comes out at the end. Like, if they have shells in it, like, okay, then...
Yeah, like, that's no bueno, but you can pick those out even if you get a little shell in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that... It's really... They really overblew the egg bit out of proportion. But this movie had some great CGI in the baseball scenes. And, like, you could tell, like, Eddie was supposed to be a good baseball player. And I don't know much about baseball. I never played myself. But, I watch enough of it and grew up in a baseball-loving environment to know what, like, a good stance looks like. And, you know, they didn't even remotely try to teach this kid how to play baseball, or any of the kids. And so, like, he'd hit the ball, and the ball would be a CGI baseball, like, so horribly done, flying in the air. Like, oh, my gosh.
I can't believe I've repressed that. Yeah, that was so bad. I'm glad that they did. They upped their baseball game eventually with High School Musical 2. I know that's outside of the realm, but mm-hmm. going from Eddie's Million Dollar Cook-Off baseball scenes to the I Don't Dance number where mm-hmm. we're doing flips to land on home plate. Like, even though you could tell that Lucas Grabeel had probably never played baseball in his life, it still looked better than Eddie's Million Dollar Cook-Off baseball scene.
Eddie's Million Dollar Cook-Off, that's just a total flop in the baseball stuff, but still a truly fantastic movie. The other good movies of that year, I mean, we got the Cheetah Girls.
Cheetah Girls, man.
What a phenomenon that turned out to be, you know?
Man, I wore so many awkwardly neon-colored cheetah print clothing items after that movie came out. Man, that was the fashionable thing. That changed young women's fashion. August 2003 was a game changer. I'm just saying. I was blue. That was my color, my blue cheetah print. you know what? And I really should pull a few of those numbers out, see if they're in a box somewhere, because... Man, Cheetah Girls, phenomenon. Cheetah Sisters.
Cheetah Sisters, five ever.
Five ever.
Five ever, for sure. No, like, I honestly think, though, I saw people who went back to buying Lisa Frank stuff.
Yes! Oh, my God!
Because people had stopped. It hadn't stopped, but it definitely had died down a bit. But since, like, colorful cheetah print came back, you know, people would get that to look like characters in the film. Like, it was cool, at least where I was at the time. It was cooler to have the, like, a colorful cheetah print rather than actual Cheetah Girls branded stuff, because it felt you were more immersive. You know, it's kind of like you're cosplaying as one of the Cheetah Girls, not fangirling over the, you know, it's a whole new level.
It's a way of life. It's a way of life. We are all Cheetah Sisters. We're one world. I think that's the next Cheetah Girls movie, but still.
I think that, you know, the diehard Cheetah Girl fans kind of split into two groups. One of them became, like, diehard cosplayers in other spaces, and the other became furries. Like, ooh, I like how Cheetah looks on me. At first, my persona is just going to be my name, like so-and-so the Cheetah, but no, it's going to... I'm now going to be Magic Gumdrop.
Magic Gumdrop? The neon green cheetah print.
The neon green cheetah.
Cheetah.
Thank you, Disney Channel. You know, it really instilled a lot for everybody. good stuff. Looking at 2004, we see the final entry of the Zeon trilogy.
Oh, end of an era.
End of an era that could and should be brought back, but it's definitely bittersweet to go back and look at Z3, which I have to say is probably, that's a down step in terms of naming. Like, the Z-quel spelt with a Z, like, snaps to that, but Z3, I feel like they could have done something better. Like, it could have been called Threenon.
You know, that would have been good.
But just Z3, I mean, that sounds like, you know... The same naming scheme you see in these horror franchises that are in, like, their 10th or 11th film, you know? It's getting kind of lazy. Still good, though, you know?
I mean, it's a movie that gave us both the Galactic Teen Supreme Contest and the Moonstock Festival, so... The culture of Xenon's world, the 21st century, according to the first one, which was so far from then.
Whoa!
Whoa! God, that whole series, and by the time you get to Z3, like, we start off weird, but we end on a whole new level of weird. But, you know, as somebody who loved Star Wars growing up and science fiction and also the pop boy band sensation and bright colors from the 80s, even though we're in, like, 2051, hell yeah. It just, Z3 really steps it up in its strangeness and... You know, was kind of like my childhood fantasy of what I wanted the world to look like. I wanted to go chill on a rocket ship, hang on the space station, and go to some, well, I don't think Protozoa was in Z3, but go to a Protozoa concert.
Oh, yeah, man. Like, everyone talks about how cool, what's his name is from the Goofy movie, Powerline.
Yeah.
Which, don't get me wrong, Powerline is a great, like, pop act in a Disney film, but compared to Protozoa, you know.
He got nothing.
Got nothing. I hate to say it, but, you know, it's the truth. It's bold, but it is nonetheless the truth.
Come at me, bro.
And then, so the same year, we get Halloween Town High.
Oh, yes, we are blessed.
Which I think is great, because you get to see the Halloween Town kids make it to the real world. And there's really a lot of metaphors in there somewhere, if you look hard enough.
You'll find them.
You'll find them. But I just like the idea of, like, oh, can the spooky kids get along with the real kids? But then we got to make a haunted house, and the spooky kids realize that's where they can contribute.
Everybody, you know what? You just got to let people shine and let their freak flag fly. And if that means making the most badass haunted house ever because you're from Spooksville, fuck yeah. Go do it.
Go do it. Make Grandma Debbie proud.
And I will say that there's another 2004 edition that I have to talk about because it's probably one of my favorite Disney Channel original movies ever. And that is Stuck in the Suburbs, because we get Taryn Killam as a pop sensation hottie heartthrob with frosted tips. Oh, we are so blessed. So blessed.
What we start to see in movies like Stuck in the Suburbs, and more so in the 2005 films, is this trend that I don't think Disney Channel has escaped, which is their, like, kids are wearing what was cool at least 3 years prior.
Yes, but did I still want to own every single thing that they wore? Yes. All of the chunky belts that go over the belt loops of your pants, the bell bottoms, the, like, funky, the like funky bedazzled hats. Oh my god. We are so blessed.
Yeah, by 2004, you're starting to phase away from that. But Disney Channel's holding on. Like, I remember at one point, I don't remember what show it was, but sometime when I was in college, like, Disney Channel happened to be on in a waiting room. And I thought, like, why are all these kids wearing what I was wearing in middle school? Like, I'm obviously not in high school, but I know what high school kids look like now. But, you know, but they're dressed like I was in 2008. Or sorry, 2007 in, like, 2015.
Oh, Disney.
It just goes to show that it's, like, every, like, the costume designers and the writers and directors are clearly, like, not the kids making it. Which, speaking of kids making it, I think that's a great transition to a great 2005 film, Now You See It.
Yes!
Where you have a kid-produced magic reality show. Now, there's so much about this movie that I just... so drawn to. And for starters, the fact that you have an ongoing straight to camera narration going on that, like, tells us what's happening.
Oh my god, that movie's so good. Also, magic is real, bitches. I just want that to be perfectly
That's
clear.
That's what it says in the closing credits. Magic is real, bitches. Well, one element of that film is that the kids make the show in the film. Like, the producers are all kids, and the cameramen are all kids. And it's fantastic because you see, like, the child cameraman, like, trying to do a handheld.
Oh.
It's, like, a massive camera, and it's all, like, tilted and, like, hanging over his shoulder. He's having a hard time. But when they show the finished product, it's like, there's no way that's what that kid was
doing. Not a chance.
Not a chance, because everyone's standing up straight and not at a 45-degree angle.
That's so true. Oh my god. You know what? Disney Channel, you know, maybe the execution wasn't perfect there, but it did inspire a generation of kids to follow their dreams. Make your at-home magic show in the backyard with your shitty camera angles. It'll turn out perfect. It'll be fine.
It'll turn out fantastic. No, that is a great movie. I also like that how Ally Mashayka's character, like, is a student at Harvard by the end.
So which good.
It's just funny because it's like, oh, you know, I wanted to go into TV, so I went to Harvard. You know, all the great TV minds go through Harvard. You know, it's like, let's pick a good sounding school, not like, oh, let's go with NYU Film School or US, like, realism, not there, but, you know, maybe she's just that talented in everything.
But I do have to say that she is one of my favorite Disney Channel stars going through the ringer. Brenda Song, we've already mentioned her earlier, but mm-hmm. Ally Michalka, I dig her. She was awesome in both the television and DCOM editions. She had a lot of really big shows under her belt, like she Phil of the Freaking Future.
And that's why she had to wear the big belt.
Exactly. Oh, sweet Allie. Cowbells. I know we mentioned cowbells, but that's like later on in the game. Ugh. She's so good.
Cowbells is great. I like how the main point of Cowbells at the end is, you know, AJ's character is just so concerned about the prom or spring dance or whatever on earth it's called, that she puts that as the date on the milk containers. Like, oh my god, all the grocery stores said no to our milk because it expires today. Ugh. Like, plot point, there we go. No, I'm a big Ally and AJ fan. I saw them perform in Austin last summer. They're still at it. They're doing a great job.
Are they seriously?
Oh, yeah. It's look them up on Spotify or YouTube. Their new tracks are pretty damn dope. And, yeah, it was a concert in the rain at this cool venue called Mohawk in downtown Austin. Really intimate and whatnot. You know, there's not a bad seat in the place. It's outside. And it was super cool. And, you know, they were playing multiple instruments. They were playing some of their classics, some of their new stuff.
Oh, my God.
They covered Casey Musgraves for a bit because they're really close with Casey Musgraves. Just learned that, like friends. Still, like, as awesome as ever. So that was a top 10 experience for me last year.
That's incredible. You know? I'm having, like, a flood of old songs coming through my head, like, this is a potential breakup song.
Yeah, that was the closing. So good. That was the encore.
Oh my god,
man, the crowd went wild. Oh my gosh,
I would be sobbing
in the air. And oh, they're fantastic performers too.
Oh my god, we are blessed, truly.
But I recommend looking up their new music. It's pretty catchy. One song was like, "Thank you." For being my sanctuary.
Oh, yes. They are my sanctuary.
Yeah, they're speaking to their fans with that one. But no, yeah, now you see it. Great movie with an all-time great actress. The other good movies of 2005, you know, which is the last year here in our little prequels dive. Kim Possible movie, So the Drama.
So good. Everything about Kim Possible is perfect, but that movie slaps.
It's a fantastic
to this day.
Opening when they're trying to save the toy executive in Tokyo, who's like basically the Pokemon guy.
Yes.
Oh, it's awesome. And I'm curious. So this is a question I ask myself frequently, and anybody who will be willing to talk about Kim Possible with me. What is your favorite ship come out of Kim Possible?
Whoa. Ooh.
There are some good ones. Like, I can see anybody with anybody in that. It's a total blank slate. I mean, obviously, like, Kim and Ron end up as a thing, but they don't have to, you know, in the wide world of imagination.
I'm kind of in, like, the Kim and Shego ship.
It's a pretty classic one. They have a great rapport.
They do. And it's like you see those memes online of like the goth chick next to the fairy princess chick. And that's not entirely relatable, but it's like good Kim. It's like light side Kim and dark side Kim.
Mm-hmm.
I love that idea of them being, they would be the cutest couple ever.
Happy ever after. I do also like Ron and Shego.
Shego and everybody, to be honest.
Shego and everybody, but, you know, but let's just be honest. I mean, Shego and Wade, Shego and Kim Possible's dad.
Shego and Kim Possible's dad.
Yeah, the rocket scientist.
Oh.
It's good, yeah, because she's just fantastic. I mean, people certainly discovered a new love for green, if you catch them adrift.
Hey.
You know, they come home to their spouse and be like, put on this green face makeup. Why? Is it because of Shrek? Yeah, Shrek. Just say Shrek. I don't know. It's not because of a cartoon show for children. But
definitely
Shrek is
not.
One. No, I mean, that's a movie. Shigo is Shigo. She meaning you, my lady, is the best. Go you, she. She go far.
She go far.
And she come right back. I don't know. Just dig in a hole here. No, that's a good movie. And then we have another pretty decent movie adaptation for, or I guess the closing movie for an animated series with the Proud Family movie that came out the same year. I found the Peanuts really creepy, but I think that was the gist. They were supposed to be really creepy.
Yeah. Proud Family, the Proud Family movie, it was true to the Proud Family, I'd feel. That movie was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
In that show.
And finally, the last movie of the prequels era to come out on Disney Channel was Twitches. Oh. Yet another good Halloween movie, through and through.
Yes! And my girls, Tia and Tamara? Heck yeah. Legendary.
Legendary indeed. Well, that's it. We've gone through the list. I think we touched, I don't know, maybe half of the 36. I haven't been paying attention, but there's plenty more. And, you know, hopefully this inspires you, the listeners. I know it's inspired me to go on to Disney Plus and revisit some of these that I haven't already, or maybe even watch a couple of them for the very first time, such as, you know, the crazy Korean horror film one, The Ring of Endless Light. Fun fact, that was Bong Joon-ho's first... That's his first movie.
I knew it. I gotta go watch Can of Worms, though. I think that's the one that's really...
The Can of Worms, yeah. Really open up a can of worms on that one. But Claire, since you are a guest on a Star Wars prequel show, I have to do my usual go-ahead here on the Babble Bubble and give you a fire round of questions, unprepared for, unplanned, relating to the Star Wars prequels before we sign off.
Let's do it.
Okay, so, you know, for those of you who are unaware... Claire here is famous on the internet for her love and adoration of a certain character, Mr. Salacious Crumb.
Oh, my baby.
And, you know, one could argue that the worst part about the prequels is that Salacious Crumb doesn't have any sort of prominent role in the Star Wars prequels. So... Claire, I'm going to do something very special for you here. I'm going to give you a time machine, and you can go back to George Lucas, and you get to tell him where the Salacious Crumb go in the Star Wars prequels.
Wow. Well, first of all, you give him a lightsaber and you make him a goddamn Jedi. I feel like he is the one that you need to listen to. I feel like he's very in tune with himself and would be very in tune with the Force. You know, but that's fine. But I think more realistically, he would end up on some sort of pirate or smuggler ship. You know, now, oh God, you see, this is difficult. He belongs so many places because everyone needs a little crumb in their life. I could also see him chilling at the Outlanders Club on Coruscant, doing stand up, making the masses laugh, cry.
Oh, I like that.
I think that's probably the best spot for him because he really is an entertainer at heart and he gives the people what they want. So, and that's more Crumb.
I'm a fan. I personally see him on the Separatist Council. That way we have guaranteed multiple show up points. You know, there he is sitting at the table just constantly snickering.
Anytime Wat Tambor messes with his dials, he just starts laughing in the corner.
He just starts laughing and starts trying to imitate, like, doing it himself. And then he does make it, he makes it to Mustafar, but he ends up, I could see him, like, hiding behind the table and, you know, peeking around the corner a la Baby Yoda, you know, when Anakin's killing everybody. And poor guy, he has to go into hiding because he's a wanted man. He's the head of the Crumb Alliance.
And what better thing to do when you're a wanted man than team up with the most powerful gangster in the galaxy?
Absolutely. You know? So there we go. That's the backstory I see for him. You know, if I could do Photoshop or video editing, I would put him in the scenes to make that a reality. I do like that he's also a stand-up comic. I think that's really funny. I mean, you could have him, like, scattered throughout all of the prequels doing stand-up comedy at different venues. You know, like, maybe, like, the little cafe... where we meet Sebulba for the first time and, you know, Jar Jar, like, tries to steal the chicken. You know, maybe Salacious Crumb is in the back there like, hey, fellas, you know your lady is a problem when... dot, dot. I don't, you know, all the theater goes wild. I like that, though, yeah. Salacious the stand-up slash separatist leaders. He's going to be both, you know? He's a man of many, many talents.
You can't just put him in one box. He's all of the above, baby.
He's all of the above and more. Anything you can imagine and not imagine. All that one. And then the sort of my final closing question here for you, Claire, is I want you to take the Disney Channel male protagonist format, which is dude who is good at blank, finds out he's also really good at other blank, and has to choose while also there is a romantic interest involved. Take that format and get characters from the Star Wars prequels and just fill in the blank.
Oh, shit. Wow. I feel so bad because now I'm trying to, like, put actual scenarios. I mean, one thing that's totally, totally true. So are we talking prequel era or movies? Or just prequel movies?
Prequel era. So you can pick from, you know, the Clone Wars show. You can even pick from Legends material if you want. You can pick from basically anything except The Rise of Skywalker if you want to, because that's the only thing that's guaranteed not a prequel, because everything's before something else. We generally try to stay with episodes 1, 2, 3, but books, TV, video games, comics, dealer's choice.
Awesome. So I think that the most realistic option is Obi-Wan Kenobi realizes he's a fucking badass Jedi. He's really good at Jedi, being a Jedi, but then he finds out he likes to fuck. And he's the love interest, obviously Satine cries. Like, you know. I feel like that is the actual story of what happened, though, so there's not all that much creativity involved in that one. I think that honestly see, this is a good one. This is a really, really good one. You're making it difficult for me.
Well, I'll throw one out here. This is one that also is officially canon, but with a little more flourish. So Anakin Skywalker is a hotshot pod racer.
Heck yeah.
And Watto is his dad figure who's like, you gotta keep pod racing, Anakin. All the way to the top, college scouts are coming to Boonta Eve. Just to look at you. But then he finds out he also can sing, dance, and use the Force.
And sing, dance, and use the Force.
So the question is, what is the route for him? Is it to stick with his original love of being a jock pod racer, or to embrace his sensitive side and become a Jedi? And there is a woman involved. It's Padme. So you know what? I mean, that's the format right there. It's all, except the singing and dancing. We don't see that on screen.
But we know it's happening.
We know it's happening, absolutely. I mean, there's no way the you're an angel bit was the only thing.
Oh, absolutely.
That got Padme over, you know. At some point, there's like Anakin just doing a whole song and dance number, like somewhere between having dinner with his mom in the actual Boonta Eve classic, where he's singing and dancing about his struggles with Padme. And that's where the sparks really fly. George Lucas just was too cowardly to put it in the final cut.
Give us the Lucas cut. Oh, wait, that it's already the prequels. Oh, man. Now I just need an Anakin Skywalker dance number. I really would like that.
Man, I don't know if Hayden can sing, but he strikes me as someone who's that talented.
Even if he couldn't sing, I'd buy it. What you could do then is you could do the Disney Channel original movie pop star format, where you just put on a singing voice that's clearly very auto-tuned and not his at all, and do a really bad lip sync job, so you make it think that Taron Killam is singing that lovely pop song, and or Hayden in this case, and then yeah, just let it fly that way. I think honestly that would make it even better. We don't have to believe he's really singing. We feel it in our hearts, though.
We feel it in our hearts. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you can't even make up a plot better than that. I think I've stolen or ruined the question by saying, you know, it's already been done with Anakin's story. If it's the Disney Channel, go ahead. I'll go ahead and throw you one more question here. Okay. Of the Disney Channel movies that we discussed, and you had to pick any one of them, recast the characters, or at least just the main characters, with Star Wars equivalent.
Oh, shit. Oh, man. That is a good question. Wow. All right. So I'm going to go with Motocrossed, because I truly enjoy that film to its core. Padme has to be under the bike. Oh. Like, you already have the space twins with Luke and Leia. I feel like had they not been separated, that Leia would totally be competing in the big pod race after Luke breaks his leg in a crash that she caused. That's just there. You know, Anakin is totally the stern dad who was also a former pod racer just trying to protect his little girl. And you know that Padme would be the cool mom who's sitting there like, yes, Leia, you can accomplish your dreams. Don't let all the boys stop you from being the most badass Senator Pod Racer Bay. I feel like that is just right there. They need to have another kid. They need to have a little to make the family complete with the kid brother who, much like his father, inherits his skills, his mechanic skills, and can fix up a pod faster than anybody. But even though he's a little kid, you know, don't underestimate him.
We could play around with the ages, and that could be Ahsoka.
Yes. Oh, Snips. You know, yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah. Just original like Clone Wars movie season one Snips. She doesn't grow up. You can plug and pick. You know, I'm telling you, this is all those Reylo AUs out there don't hold a candle to the Motocross Skywalker family.
Oh, not a chance.
Brings joy to my heart. You know, this is what could have been.
You're done right.
Had Ki-Adi Mundi not sent Yoda off planet, and Yoda had been able to go with Mace Windu to arrest Chancellor Palpatine, and Anakin would be okay.
Oh, what could have been?
What could have been? I'm telling you, Ki-Adi Mundi, he's the real villain of the prequel trilogy. Just by mentioning the droid attack on the Wookiees and Yoda having to leave, you know, it all fell apart from there.
Tis.
Anyhow, this has been an absolute delight.
It has been. It's a lovely walk down memory lane.
Absolutely. And I hope that you, the listeners, enjoyed this walk down memory lane. And for those of you who I know fall into more of the older crowd who listen to the Babble Bubble, we love you tremendously. If you didn't grow up with these movies, but you have Disney Plus, maybe have a little peek into what the childhood of a certain group of millennials was like. They're good films. Everything that we talked about here, highly recommend.
And after a bottle of wine, even you're going to be cheering on Johnny Tsunami in the snowboard race down the mountain. I promise you that.
That those skier kids suck.
Yeah, fuck skiing. Just kidding, I ski, so.
Snowboard is for the win. All right, well, Claire, do you want to drop your info in the sign out here?
Sure.
Follows.
All right, so I am on the Imperial Senate podcast, where another familiar face has made an appearance in the past on our live podcast. But you can follow us at Imp Senate Pod. And if you want to see me share photos of my cat or rave over Salacious Crumb, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at CStribs.
Cool. Well, looks like we're here at the end of the show, per usual. The Babble Bubble will catch you all around the pod racing corner.